Tonight's theme is Faith in the Wilderness Means. We're doing a whole series on what does faith in the wilderness mean, as you probably noticed, and we're looking at the book of Numbers. So tonight's theme is Faith in the Wilderness Means accepting that God's plans are good. Accepting that God's plans are good. I have a confession to begin with, which some of you may be able to identify with more than others. I hate exams. I just hate them. The thought of an exam just makes me... There is no part of me that looks forward to an exam. It's as simple as that. I mean, I know there may be some people here who think, oh, good, I love exams, and you're not going to be able to understand what I've just said, but I just hate exams. And one of the reasons I hate exams is because I know they're good for me. So it's a bit paradoxical, if that's a word. But today's theme is about the Israelites' big exam. Think of it in those terms. It's about the Israelites' big exam. The book of Hebrews, or sorry, that's not the book of Hebrews, the book of Numbers in the Hebrew Bible is called In the Wilderness. So that's where we got our theme for these few weeks we've been looking at it. It's In the Wilderness. That's what the title is in the Hebrew Bible. God had rescued the Israelites from slavery, from a horrible, horrible, horrible life in Egypt. An unimaginably horrible life. If you want to know how horrible it was, just read the first few chapters of Exodus. And he had promised them a land flowing with milk and honey that they could settle in and be at peace. But in order to get there, they've got to go through the wilderness. Of course, there's parallels with us today. As the people of God living in a post-Christian world, we're sort of in the wilderness right now. These are our wilderness years. There's also a parallel with us in terms of our individual journey of faith. We have been granted freedom from our past, a bit like the Israelites were set free from Egypt. And we've been promised, you know, joys unlimited, peace everlasting, you know, all that comes with the idea of being in God's near presence. But in the meantime, we've got the wilderness to sort of work our way through. And for the Israelites, the wilderness time, their wilderness years, it was a time of preparation. It was like their time at school. They had to learn to get on with each other because they're a disparate bunch of people. I mean, the word Hebrew is a language term. They spoke the Hebrew language. So they're all the people who ended up speaking the Hebrew language who are slaves in Egypt. They're not necessarily all children of Abraham. They just happen to be Hebrew language speakers. Most of them are children of Abraham, but they happen to be the Hebrew language. And so they're all bunched together, and they have to sort themselves out, and they have to become a community. And that happens in the wilderness. And they also have got to learn to trust God. When we kicked this series off, we talked about how God sent a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, and he repeated over and over and over again, whenever the pillar moves, you've got to move. If the pillar doesn't move, then you've got to stay. And the point he was making is, listen, it's not a case of you wandering your way around in the wilderness and I being with you. It's a case of me leading you. You've got to trust me to lead you through the wilderness. That's how this is going to work from now on. You are now my people. You've got to learn to trust me. So when I stay, you stay. When I go, you go. So trust means accepting that God's plans for you are good. Accepting that somehow, despite the fact you're not quite sure what's up ahead, you know that God's plans are good. And their big exam came when eventually, having been in the wilderness, they reached the borders of the promised land. Okay? So have all these years in the wilderness paid off? Have all these years of schooling paid off? Now's the exam. How are they going to respond? Are they going to do well? Or are they going to have to do a reset? And that I'll stop the analogy now. Even the talking about things like this is making me feel nervous. So we're going to look at Numbers chapter 14, but please don't look it up. It's quite a big, long chapter, and it is, I think it's got about 46 verses in it. But originally, it would have been told like a story, because that's where a lot of the Old Testament, particularly the first five books in the Old Testament, come from. There were stories that were passed on and passed on and passed on. And so I've got four voices. Do the four voices, do you want to just come and sit somewhere so that you can pass the microphone to each other? Let's just put four seats out for you. There we go. It's like a drama workshop, isn't it? Guys, imagine this. Imagine you're hearing this for the first time.
That night, all the people of the community raised their voices and wept aloud. All the Israelites grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole assembly said to them, "If only we had died in Egypt or in this desert. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land only to let us fall by the sword? Our wives and children will be taken as plunder. Wouldn't it be better for us to go back to Egypt?" And then they said to each other, "We should choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell face down in front of the whole Israelite assembly gathered there. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of
Jephunneh,
who were among those who had explored the land, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and will give it to us. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will swallow them up. Their protection is gone, but the Lord is with us. Do not be afraid of them."
But the whole assembly talked about stoning them. Then the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all the Israelites. The Lord said to Moses, "How long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me, in spite of all the signs I've performed among them? I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them, but I will make you into a nation greater and stronger than they." Moses said to the Lord, "Then the Egyptians will hear about it. By your power, you brought these people up from among them. And they will tell the inhabitants of this land about it. They have already heard that you, Lord, are with these people, and that you, Lord, have been seen face to face, that your cloud stays over them, and that you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. If you put all these people to death, leaving none alive, the nations who've heard this report about you will say, 'The Lord was not able to bring these people into the land he promised them on oath, so he slaughtered them in the wilderness.' Now may the Lord's strength be displayed just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger, abounding in love and forgiving sin and rebellion, that yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. In accordance with your great love, forgive the sin of these people, just as you have pardoned them from the time they left Egypt until now."
The Lord replied, "I have forgiven them as you asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. But because my servant Caleb has a different spirit and follows me wholeheartedly, I will bring him into the land he went to, and his descendants will inherit it. Since the Amalekites and the Canaanites are living in the valleys, turn back tomorrow and set out towards the desert along the route to the Red Sea." The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "How long will this wicked community grumble against me? I have heard the complaints of these grumbling Israelites. So tell them, 'As surely as I live, declares the Lord, I will do to you the very things I heard you say. In this desert, your bodies will fall. Every one of you, 20 years old or more, who was counted in the census and who has grumbled against me, not one of you will enter the land I swore with uplifted hand to make your home. except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, son of Nun. As for your children that you said would be taken as plunder, I will bring them in to enjoy the land you have rejected. But you, your bodies will fall in this desert. Your children will be shepherds here for 40 years, suffering for your unfaithfulness, until the last of your bodies lies in the desert. For 40 years, 1 year for each of the 40 days you explore the land, you will suffer for your sins and know what it is like to have me against you. I, the Lord, have spoken, and I will surely do these things to this whole wicked community which has banded together against me. They will meet their end in this desert. Here they will die.
So the men Moses had sent to explore the land returned and made the whole community grumble against them by spreading a bad report about it. These men, responsible for spreading the bad report and about the land, were struck down and died of a plague before the Lord. Of the men who went to explore the land, only Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, survived. When Moses reported this to all the Israelites, they mourned bitterly. Early next morning, they went up towards the hill country. "We have sinned," they said. "We will go up to the place the Lord promised." But Moses said, "Why are you disobeying the Lord's command? This will not succeed. Do not go up, because the Lord is not with you. You will be defeated by your enemies, for the Amalekites and the Canaanites will face you there, because you have turned away from the Lord. He will not be with you, and you will fall by the sword." Nevertheless, in their presumption, they went up towards the high hill country, though neither Moses nor the ark of the Lord's covenant moved from the camp. Then the Amalekites and Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and attacked them and beat them all the way down to Hormah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, what's the verdict? How did they do when it came to the exam? Did they do well? No. They could have done a lot better, really, couldn't they? Instead of listening to Caleb and Joshua, instead of listening to God, they listened to the doubters. All the doubters wanted to tell them about was all the giants that were in the land. If you look at Numbers chapter 13, you get the whole story. They came back laden with the produce of the land. It was a wonderful land, but it was full of giants, and we're just grasshoppers, they said. We can't do this. We can't do this. And that sort of triggers a major rebellion. They rebel against the plan. They want to start going back. They don't want to start going forward at all. They rebel against Moses. They want to stone Moses and Aaron because somehow it's their fault for bringing them this far. And they rebel against God. They refuse to trust him. Despite all that he's done for them, he's already led them out of slavery. He's already led them through the Red Sea. He's already given them water to drink and food to eat and a pillar to guide them and protection from all their enemies and brought them to this land. Despite having done all of that, they still refuse to trust him. So, what are the lessons that we can learn for our lives today? Well, I've divided them into three parts. First part is, what is one of the greatest enemies of faith? Okay, that's what we're going to look at first. And then we're going to look at the marks of leadership, because I think Moses shows one of the true marks of leadership in today's passage. And then finally, we're going to look at godly wisdom, because I think God actually deals with the situation fairly and justly and wisely. So those are the three things we're going to be looking at tonight. The first thing, one of the greatest enemies of faith is fear. Simple as that. The people were scared witless, and that just, it was like manacles around their ankles. They just couldn't move. They're paralyzed by fear. So when God calls us to do something or go somewhere or be someone, the thing that is most likely to stop us is fear. And it's true. I can testify to that myself. The fear of giants, the fear of failure, the self-doubt, God doubt, it paralyzes us. We hide it well, because no one likes to admit that they're afraid. We hide it well, but if it's something that we're suffering from, it has two symptoms, and we see them in this passage. And so if you spot the symptoms, then that will lead you to the root cause. Okay, so the root cause is fear, but the symptoms may not appear so on the surface. The first symptom I spotted, something that we always need to look out for, is a willingness to accept what is second best. God was promising the people the promised land, but they were scared. So they decided to stay in the wilderness. They even wanted to go back to Egypt, and a willingness to accept what is second best. They thought, well, at least in the wilderness we're safe. At least we know the wilderness. It's not very pleasant. You know, it's got its drawbacks, but, you know, we know our wilderness. We just want to stay here. Thank you very, very much. So that willingness to accept the second best, that you know, we don't want to step outside of our comfort zone. God's calling us out of our comfort zone. But no, we're fine as we are, thank you very much. Behind that is a lack of trust that God's plans for us are good. And that's a symptom of it all. So that's the first symptom. The second symptom is a bit more obvious. It's a culture of grumbling and moaning, which sort of reveals a critical and a cynical spirit. The Israelites turned moaning and grumbling into an art form. I mean, if you want to read the history of the Israelites, it is just moan after moan after moan. First of all, Moses says, well, God sends Moses, I will rescue you from slavery in Egypt. And the Israelites say, well, we're not sure about that. And he says, no, I really will. I'm going to go to Pharaoh. Oh, don't do that. No, I'm going to go to Pharaoh. I say, let my people. Oh, are you sure? So he goes to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, oh, not sure about this. So he starts persecuting the slaves even more. And they say, see, told you. He says, no, stick with me. And you all know the story of the 10 plagues. And eventually, miraculously, Pharaoh lets them go. And they head off into the strip of land between where they were slaves, Goshen in Egypt, and the Red Sea, and suddenly there's the Red Sea. Ah! So what do? They turn on Moses and say, why did you bring us here to die? And then Pharaoh starts coming after, oh, you did this deliberately. You brought us here to die. You did, didn't you? And Moses holds out his staff, and the Red Sea parts, and they go through, and they close the water, and Egypt and all the armies dead. They have no water to drink. Why did you bring us here to die? So God gives them water, and they've got no food. Why did you bring us here to die? We are much better off in Egypt. So God gives them manna. And after a few weeks of eating the manna, oh, we had meat to eat in Egypt. Why won't you give us meat to eat? So God gives them quail. And you know, and it just goes on and on and on. They turn the whole thing into a complete art form. We never do that, do we? No, we never do that. I didn't think so. In a sense, every time they come up against an ordeal, they start looking backwards. They stop looking forward, they start looking backwards. And you know, as anybody who looks back to the good old days are always a lot better than they really were. I mean, you think of what was going on in Egypt, for goodness sake. How could they possibly ever want to go back to that? And then in the end, they turn on their leader. So groaning and mumbling about the circumstances, groaning and mumbling about God, and then they're picking up stones to stone Moses and Aaron. It's that. So those are the two symptoms. A lack of trust in your leadership, a lack of trust in God, a critical spirit, that's the one, and the other one is a willingness to accept the second best. If you recognize those things, it's a sign of fear. And fear is the enemy of faith. The marks of leadership. By the way, the reason I asked Susan not to do too much singing at the beginning was because I thought it'd be good at the end if Susan and Anne and Nikki came up and sang some fairly well-known songs. But during that time, we offered prayer for each other. Okay? So we'll be singing, and I'll explain it all as it happens. But just to give you a heads up, so you've got a rough idea, and it doesn't come as a surprise. The marks of true leadership. I love the sort of the disarming honesty of the passage, because the people rebel. They don't want to go into the promised land. They pick up stones. They want to. They don't trust God. And God's reaction is, right. Did you pick that up? Right. I have had enough of this. I have absolutely had it right up to here with this horrible lot of people. Ungrateful. You know, he just goes on to this massive rant. And he basically says, right, that's it. They're finished. I'm going to start again. You could make it part of a lovely drama. You know, it's so real. Because doesn't any leader feel that sometimes? Right, I've had enough. I'm not going to get any more detailed than that. But there's one or two of us around here, leaders of people. And you know that feeling. So there's God doing one of those, right, I've had enough feelings. And I wonder if he's just testing Moses here. I mean, maybe he's not. Maybe he's just expressing himself. Or maybe he's testing Moses. Because we know that God is not really like that. And Moses then goes on to remind him, hang on, God, you're not actually like that. But that comes back to the quality of leader that Moses is. Because I think the real test of leadership is not when everybody loves you and things are going well. I think the real test of leadership kicks in when nobody likes you and everybody's having a good moan. Okay, so that's when we see what a great leader Moses is. Look what he does. First of all, he says, actually, God, have you thought that if you destroy all these people now and start again, how bad it's going to look for you? You know, all these promises you made about leading these people and rescuing them, taking them promised land, what are the Egyptians going to think? So there's this very sort of human little sort of diplomatic language going on. And then he goes on to say, and by the way, have you forgotten that they're always like this? They've been moaning nonstop. They moaned about the water. They moaned about this. Oh, the water wasn't sweet enough. Oh, the food wasn't meat. You know, all this stuff. I mean, it's not as if this shouldn't come as a surprise to you, God. You know what they're like. And then finally, he asks them to give him another chance. Because you've already given them lots of chances. So there's this lovely wee dialogue that Moses has with God. And Moses, if you like, is just standing between God and the people. And he's saying, whoa. And the reason he's doing that is because he loves them. And the mark of true leadership is when you can stand between, well, you can stand up for people who are giving you grief, who are making your life miserable. And we've got a wonderful model in Jesus. Jesus, the good shepherd. What's the sign of a good shepherd? The sign of a good shepherd is he looks after all of his sheep. He doesn't just look after the ones that are very good and eat grass nearby and go into the fold, you know, when they're told to. And I mean, you remember the famous parable? How many sheep were in the fold? 99. How many sheep were lost? One. What does the good shepherd do? He goes out and he looks for the lost sheep, because every single one of his sheep mattered to him. And there's, I mean, Moses was a shepherd before he became leader of Israel. So there's the mark. I often wonder, you know, how many times would Jesus, the good shepherd, go and look for that lost sheep? You know, gets lost once. Right, go and find that lost sheep. Bring him home. Right, you stay there, okay? Runs off again. Right, go and get him. Now, listen, you saw what happened. Just stay there. goes and gets, you know, how many times? Would it be once, twice? Would it be seven times? Would it be 70 times, seven times? The mark of a good leader loves his sheep, warts and all. And we see that coming out in Moses. And it's an echo of Jesus. So that's the second thing I was going to talk about. And then the final thing. What does this tell us of God's wisdom? God's wisdom, if you like, is demonstrating how what he decides to do when he's confronted with this rebellion. How is he going to deal with it? And I think he deals in a way that combines grace and mercy and truth and discernment. You know, there's a wisdom there as well as a compassion there. And I think we can learn a lot from that as well. So the first thing he does, God acknowledges that the majority have actually failed the test. They've had all this time in the wilderness, a time of preparation, you know, all these chances to just put their trust in God. When the big crunch comes, they fail the test. And in his wisdom, he realizes that he cannot send them into the promised land. That it would be like lambs to slaughter, sending them into the promised land. They do not have enough faith to cope with the giants in the promised land. So there's just no point. For their sakes, there's no point in doing it. And so his judgment is, well, okay, you want to stay in the wilderness? You stay in the wilderness. And they live out their lives in the wilderness for the next 40 years. Godly wisdom. Makes me worry about, you know, careful what you ask for. You might just get it. The second thing I noticed that he recognizes Caleb and Joshua, and they wouldn't have been the only ones, but he recognizes that not everybody has failed the test. And he promises that they will eventually be able to enter the promised land. So while some are just not up for it, he recognizes those who are up for it. But he doesn't say, right, off you go. No, they have to endure the penance, if you like, of 40 years waiting before they can actually do it. It's not their fault. It's nothing to do with them. But there's something collective about this, a shared sin. I'm reminded of when we pray the Lord's Prayer, we say, forgive us our sins. You know, we as the community of God, we share each other's faults and failings. It's part of who we are. And that may well mean that what we'd love to do tomorrow isn't going to happen, because we're just collectively not up for it. But the example God gives, or the wisdom God gives, is, well, that's fine. We'll have to wait a lot longer. And ultimately, those who are up for it will be able to claim that promise. But they'll have to wait too. They're going to have to endure that because they're part of something bigger. And then the final thing, which is the scariest thing, God recognizes the cancer of false leadership, because those who were chosen by the tribes to go and spy out the land, 10 of those came back. They were the ones who led the people astray. They were the ones who came back saying, there are giants, we can't do it, let's stone Moses, let's go back. You know, they actually came back, and in a sense, they're the ones who are culpable. And they're the ones who have to pay the penalty. It's like Moses says, well, they cannot be part of this community because they're the ones who are rebelling against Moses. They're the ones who are rebelling against me. And whatever happens, they've forfeited their right to be part of this community. And it's a scary thing for us. And I don't want to get into a great big ethical debate about, well, what does this say of God and his justice and his grace and his compassion? But what it does say is that there is a big responsibility on leadership not to take people down your road rather than taking people down God's road. There's a big responsibility. In fact, there's another scary verse in the Bible where Jesus says, to anyone who leads one of these little ones astray, it would be better for them if they'd had a millstone tied around their neck and thrown into the deepest part of the ocean. It's a real big warning, and it's a real big responsibility on the shoulders of people who are in a position where they can influence others within the church, that you've got to stay in tune with God. It's a big privilege, but it's a big responsibility that comes with it. Final thoughts. In Christian life, there will be times of testing, both personal and collective. There's going to be a time of testing this coming week. I mean, we've talked about the big prayer and praise thing on Tuesday night, but then Saturday, Balmwell, healing service. I mean, that wasn't my idea, you know. I'm not one of these people who say, oh, good, there's going to be a healing service at the Balmwell. So it's right out of my comfort zone. But I have to trust that God's plans are good. I mean, if you like, the Balmwell's been turned into a wilderness. It's decrepit, it's falling apart. It's in the grounds of the Toby Carvery. No idea who's going to be there. Are we going to have table loads of lager drinkers on a hot, sunny day? I don't know. Is it going to be pouring with rain? I don't know. Who's going to come? I don't know. As a congregation, are we going to support this? Well, I'm sure if I'm feeling, I'm not the only one. Oh, I'll leave that to the folks who'd like that sort of stuff. There are times of testing. And that's a collective time of testing. But there's also times of testing in our individual lives. And you will recognize those times of testing. You may be facing giants now in your lives. You will recognize them. So, let's finish with this. If musician folks want to head up and get ready to play, but also tune into what I'm saying because it applies to you as well. I know we're not very large in number tonight, but this applies to you as well. I want you to think about these questions that I've penciled in. If this is your wilderness time, what was your Egypt and what is your promised land? If this is your wilderness time, what was your Egypt and what is your promised land? In other words, where is God leading you from and where is he leading you to? Is it a place? Is it a project? Is it a person? Is it a job? Is it a situation? What does it look like? And are there any giants in that land? Are there any giants in that land? What are you afraid of? Is it failure? Is it rejection? Is it loss? What are you afraid of? I find that sometimes it's good to name our fears. And so this is the plan. I'm going to ask Lindsay, my good wife, if you'd come and join me. And we'll just go and we'll sit over there. And I'm going to ask Susan and Nikki and Anne to lead us in a time of praise. If you want to come and tell us what your giants are, what they look like, then we'll pray for you. Okay? All in complete confidence. Let's do it now.